Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. For all of you all over the world, for all of our stations that are listening in, we welcome you. Today, on Health and Nutrition, flaxseed is just as good as fish for your omega-3 fatty acids. Green leafy vegetables thin your blood and help oxygen circulation. Brain inflammation is a hallmark of autism. That's according to a large-scale study from Johns Hopkins University. Well, then the question is, what causes brain inflammation in young people? Let me think. Vaccines, mercury, aluminum, polysorbate 80, formaldehyde. The 11 most significant foods or factors are guaranteed to depress your immune system. These are things that you don't want, but the average American is consuming most of these every day. No surprise, then, that they have defective immune systems. The Council for Responsible Nutrition announces new research that shows 68% of U.S. adults are using dietary supplements. That's good news. And pycnogenol, that's from pine bark, reduces cold symptoms and the duration of colds, and more on Health and Nutrition. Also today, 10 reasons why you may want to consider living away from the cities, away from the suburbs, in what I predict will be the biggest migration. It'll be the most significant paradigm shift, and it's already happening. The villages of tomorrow. Millions of Americans are already relocating. A lot have no knowledge of this at all. I'll share why this is a good idea. From Jonah Gabriel from his report. Also today, glyphosate disrupting root systems, destroying soil nutrients, and eliminating earthworms from Julie Wilson. None of that is good. Here's my question of the day that I'll be doing a commentary on later and then opening up for talkback. First, I'm going to start with a brief article by Dr. Mark Hicks and the current issue of Psychology Today. It's called All Kids Should Go to College, A Great American Myth. Striving for college is not always a good thing for students. He'll give his opinion, I'll share mine, and then I'm going to open up our call so you have a chance to share yours. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Harold Koenig. He's a medical doctor down in Durham, North Carolina. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University Medical Center. We're going to talk about something you never hear about on the mainstream media and rarely on alternative media. A look at the scientific evidence of how spirituality and religion enhances a person's physical, mental, and social health. I thought that this would be of interest to everyone in the audience. So that's what we have. Let's begin. Now, a lot of people know that flax seeds are good. Now, if you eat flax seeds whole, most of them will not be digested properly. They're good for fiber, and for those that do open up in the intestine, they'll benefit you. However, that is not the form that I believe you should be taking it. Instead, flaxseed oil, the cold-pressed oil, is what really benefits us. That helps our heart, our brain, it turns off inflammation in the body. But historically, almost all of the physicians and scientists in America suggest that if we want to get our omega-3 fatty acids, we should be taking it from fish oil. Okay, you can take it from fish oil if you want. But does the science support that you're getting a better source? The answer now is no. Flaxseed is just as good as fish for the omega-3s. And we can grow organic flaxseed in unlimited amounts, and yet there's not an unlimited amounts of fish. So, here's the latest Marodell news about the reasons why we should be getting our flaxseed oil in our diet on a daily basis and not the fish. I'll quote this. Researchers, quote, explain that the fish-based omega-3 fatty acids, the DEP, or DHA and EPA, have a lot more research on them, but that doesn't mean the plant-based alpha-linolenic acid, the ALAs, should be discounted. In a review of the existing research, the nutritionists concluded that the plant-based alpha-linolenic acid, or the ALA, is just as effective at preventing heart disease as EPA and DHA. Quote, this is from the study from the distinguished professor of nutrition at Penn State University, and it's an article, quote, our understanding of the cardiovascular disease benefits of ALA, that's the plant-based flaxseed, has advanced markedly during the past decade. Based on the current evidence, the ALA decreases cardiovascular risk. End quote. So now, for all of the people who were vegans but took the flaxseed oil from, or took the omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil, no need to do that anymore. And for everyone else, you're going to get the plant-based less expensively than if you got the fish oil. We know the green vegetables are good for us. How good? Well, here's why. You should take your greens as fresh vegetables, organic, wherever possible, locally grown, or as green juices. Now, that is easy to get. Or the best of all, most concentrated, most healing, green powders, because it was the vegetable that was the juice, and you eliminated that which was the water, and you get what's powerful. Here's the latest on leafy greens from the Journal of Federation of American Societies of Experimental Biology. Quote, nitrate from leafy greens may thin the blood and help oxygen circulate around the body more efficiently, according to one of three studies conducted at the University of Cambridge and University of Southampton. So Cambridge University did the study. Now, we know that when you eat your vegetables, especially the green ones, you're getting a nitrate-rich vegetable, a chemical in the body, and that reduces the production of a hormone, which determines red blood cell counts and thereby impacts our ability to circulate oxygen and how thick it is. The British Heart Foundation, which funded the research, said the findings highlighted how a simple change in diet could help alleviate symptoms of people suffering from certain heart defects and high blood pressure and reduce the risk of stroke and heart attack. So that's good. This is from Professor Martin on this, who led the study, quote, these findings suggest simple dietary changes may offer treatments for people suffering from heart and blood vessel diseases that cause too many red blood cells to be produced. It is also exciting, as it may have broader implications in sports science, could aid recovery of patients in intensive care by helping us understand how oxygen can be delivered to our cells more efficiently. So, there were three studies, including the Journal of Physiology published these, and also the Journal of Diabetes, all looked at nitrates' capacity to stimulate conversion of white bad blood fat cells into what are called beige cells, which burn fat to produce heat. And eat your vegetables, help your heart, prevent stroke, help with high blood pressure, and help with diabetes. That's what the bottom line is. Now, we know that one of the characteristics of autism is an inflammation of the brain. And we've seen this repeatedly in studies. If you took two children who were equal in the brain, and one was given a series of vaccines, just generally a series of vaccines, and the other was not, you'll see how quickly the brain responds, because there are specific chemicals in vaccines that are really radically inflammatory to the brain. This is also true of adults, by the way. And when you look at the agency of government that is specifically and exclusively there to compensate parents for the very expensive medical cost for the rest of their lives of a kid who has generally a short lifespan once they have autism. And here they've laid out over $100 million because sometimes it takes over $500,000 a year for all the medical treatments. And the kid can never take care of themselves. In the orthodox medical paradigm, we've actually reversed full-blown autism. In fact, to prove this, this is what's amazing to me. On the one hand, we should as a nation be challenging the entire vaccine public health paradigm. We have immunologists, professors of immunology, toxicology, who will say and have said on the record, the latest being in the documentary I produced this year and released this year, though I have not put it in general release yet, The Silent Epidemic. I didn't get a single anti-vaccine person for the film. Instead, I got people who historically were all pro-vaccine. Now, these were all scientists. Therefore, they had the ability and knowledge to know the body, especially in immunology and toxicology, professors of toxicology. And so I ask them this question. Do vaccines build a healthy immune system, therefore protecting a person who's been vaccinated against what they were vaccinated for? Not one of them said yes. They would all say this. There is no gold standard to prove that if you had 1,000 people vaccinated with, let's say, smallpox, you'd be able to prevent smallpox in those people. All right, then I ask immunologists the same question. Can you build a natural immunity this way? They said no. I never see these people. I've never seen one of them in any national discussion or brought in by the media to say, give us your opinion of the flu vaccine or the chickenpox, measles, the pertussis vaccine, the MMR vaccine. Never once have any of these people been brought in. Instead, they are the normal scientist working as specialists in a field who have an intimate knowledge of the dangers of vaccines. So then I ask them this. Are vaccines safe for any given individual done as a single vaccine or as a combination vaccine? And to a person, they said, no. To the contrary, they are toxic. All right, as a toxicologist, this is your specialty. This is what you spent these decades doing, publishing in peer-reviewed literature. What does a single vaccine do to the person's immune system? And then they would each go through all of the things that happens to a person's immune system. Then I said, all right, that's an adult. Now, what about a baby that doesn't even have its own immune system developed yet? It takes at least a year minimal for a natural immune system to develop. And then they go through these horror stories. Well, we put all these in the film. Now, we had a premiere, one showing only in New York City at the Ethical Culture Center. 1,000 people showed up, watched it, including physicians who came over to me after the showing saying, I didn't know any of this. I'm not a toxicologist. I'm not an immunologist. I'm not a vaccinologist. There actually is no such thing as a vaccinologist, but that's what they like to call themselves. There is no scientific term. We use it, but we use it as if you were speculating. But there is no such thing. We have cardiologists, we have oncologists, we don't have a vaccinologist. In any case, they would say they had no knowledge. And I said, but then how can you go ahead and give vaccines to all your patients without knowing the harmful effects and the fact that there is no guarantee that you can prevent the disease to which they're being vaccinated. So they simply said because they were trusting the magazines, they were trusting the CDC, the FDA, they were trusting the information received by the pharmaceutical industry. Big mistake. Now, I give you that as background. Why? Because Johns Hopkins University has just completed this study and published it in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Communications. Quote, brain inflammation, a hallmark of autism, large-scale analysis shows. Quote, from Johns Hopkins University. Quote, while many different combinations of genetic traits can cause autism, brains affected by autism share a pattern of ramped up immune responses. An analysis of data from autopsied human brains reveal. The study, a collaborative effort between Johns Hopkins and University of Alabama, included over 72 autistic and brain control brains. It was published this week. There are many different ways of getting autism, but we found that they all have the same downstream effect. And what we do not know is whether this immune response is making things better in the short term or worse in the long term, end quote. Now, this is from them. I'm not editorializing at all. So let me add this in. All of the scientific literature, all of it, shows that every vaccine will cause inflammation. Every single scientific study in the world shows you that mercury is pro-inflammatory, aluminum, pro-inflammatory, formaldehyde, pro-inflammatory, and these other ingredients, including fetal cells, pro-inflammatory. So that's the one thing that all autistic brains have in common, and that's the one thing that all vaccines do. Now, there are other causes, yes, but that's the biggest one. And they knew that because they got together in secret, they meaning the CDC, the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, vaccine manufacturers, and the World Health Organization. And in secret, they had to come up with a way of changing the outcome of a 100,000 study, persons, kids in a study that showed autism from vaccines. That was called the Simpson Wood. And we would never have known this secret meeting occurred to cover it up, the dangers of vaccines and the autism relationship, had it not been for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who through a Freedom of Information Act got the records and then shared them. And that was just the beginning of the cover-up. Now we have this author, this scientist at the CDC, going on the record, first as a disguised whistleblower, then outing himself, Dr. Thompson, saying that they showed the wrong information on autism rates in African-American children and that they shouldn't have done it. That then confirmed that what Dr. Andrew Wakefield was saying about autism MMR vaccine and 11 other members of his scientific research team in England was correct. It was absolutely correct. So at least the truth has come out, but the mainstream media refuses to discuss it, investigate it, or have any debate on it. Now, as people that listen to this radio show know, we have invited the top pro-vaccine advocates on this program to debate me personally. I don't need anyone else to debate them. After writing 27 major papers, all scholarly, on the dangers of vaccine, their lack of safety and efficacy, and producing 3 multi-award-winning documentaries, I'm more than capable of going up against any of these people. They have refused to come on. We've invited them multiple times. They refuse to come on. But you do see them going on television all the time when they don't have someone who can challenge them in return. Now, I will not tell you whether to vaccinate or not. I'll simply say, before you vaccinate, do your homework. Because the parents who didn't or who trusted, today, there's tens of thousands injured from Gardasil vaccine, over 150 dead. Now, we show their photographs up on my website. And by the way, just today alone, I posted over 100 articles. We post throughout the day. We post 20 out of 24 hours. And we post more important articles on progressive-themed issues than any other website in the world. Maybe that's why over 250 million visits to our website this year alone. Not even the whole year. Over a quarter billion. Because people want the truth. They don't want left-right political dichotomy. They want, what are the facts? And then they can assess them. And we do a lot on vaccines and their dangers and the lack of science. And I believe that will be another major effort on the popular front in the upcoming year. Now, I'll finish up this segment with the foods that I believe we should not have, or the elements, the factors that can influence our immune system, because many of us now are trying to have strong immunity. But if you're doing the following, you're challenging that. First and foremost, sugar. Sugar is one of the most dangerous things you could put into your body. And if sugar were invented today for the first time, it is my belief that it would never be allowed onto the market or in our bodies because it would be considered too dangerous. We have all the studies now, and I have a major article that we update every 2 months. So we've been doing this for over 30 years. So everything you need to know about what's wrong with sugar is in the article. It's there. All these articles there are free to download and use, and they're all completely footnoted. It leaches minerals from your body. It upsets the pH of your body. It spikes your blood sugar. It exhausts your pancreas. It makes you more susceptible to cancer and heart disease and diabetes and obesity. In fact, here's what most people are not aware of. The immune-suppressing effects of sugar start with less than 30 seconds of consumption. You're already going to spend the next 5 hours with a compromised immune system. So every time you have sugar, you just put your immune system in a straitjacket for the next 5 hours. Well, hold on. What about people who have sugar for breakfast, sugar for lunch, sugar afternoon, sugar at night? Then that's why you're sick or more susceptible to colds and flus and other diseases. The next is lack of sleep. And more than not, when we do not have a good night's sleep, we make ourselves susceptible to infections that otherwise we would not have. You need quality, deep sleep so your body can secrete melatonin from the pineal gland. And melatonin is a very significant hydroxyl radical scavenger. In fact, it's twice as good as vitamin E or vitamin C at stopping, attaching to, and neutralizing peroxyl free radicals. Vaccines are also important because all the advice of medical professionals who are wrong and almost wrong about everything they tell us with chronic care, vaccines hamper the immune system and do not enhance it. Vaccines contain all the chemicals, heavy metals, aluminum, mercury I've been mentioning just now, and those are immunosuppressive. In fact, mercury from your flu vaccine actually causes change in the lymphocyte activity and decreases lymphocyte viability. In fact, vaccines also alter our T-cell helper and suppressor ratios, just like seen in AIDS. And this ratio is a key indicator of proper functioning immune system. They suppress our immunity merely by overtaxing our immune system with foreign materials. Then we have drugs. More research on hundreds of different drugs suggests they increase your susceptibility to infection by destroying your immune system. All of them, especially right at the top, the statins, and then the antipsychotic and antidepressives and the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and the COX-2 inhibitors, the anti-inflammatories. Then alcohol. There is no debate that alcohol adversely affects the heart and the brain. And it can also affect the adult brain cells by as much as 40%. So it impedes the ability of the immune system to fight infections and disease. The last thing you want in your body when you're trying to fight a cold or a flu is alcohol. Refined grains, white flour, instant rice, enriched pastas, breads, bagels, muffins, donuts, they're all impairing the immune system. In fact, there was a study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found the ability of white blood cells to kill bacteria is significantly hampered for up to 5 hours after eating 100 grams, that's just 3 ounces, of bread or pasta or any other processed food. Chronic stress. We know what that does. By turning on the hormones like cortisol, and that then causes the reduction in the good prostaglandins. And if you have chronic stress, you're more susceptible to colds and flu. A lack of vitamin D, dehydration, anxiety and fear, those are the extra elements that really impact your immune system. So de-stress, yoga, exercise, lots of clean water, juices, greens and reds, the fruits, the berries. If you can't get them fresh, organic, buy them frozen, organic. Get your powders, get the essential oils, build your immune system. Get through the winter with no colds, no flus. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. First, I want to say thank you to all the people who came for the 35 screenings of the new film, Poverty Inc. Last night, we had a wonderful full house and a lot of wonderful activists and people who have been in the social, environmental movements, political movements, and really appreciate the support. Look forward to this Sunday, when I will be in the only other appearance I'll be making on this at the Cinema Arts Cinema in Huntington at noon on Sunday. I'll be doing a lecture afterwards. Call the theater at 631-423-7610, 631-423-7610 on Long Island, Huntington. The Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, noon, Sunday. Now, also before we go to all of our issues and our guest and our talkback segment, I've finished not one but two cookbooks. I just decided to do two at the same time because I got into a whole mindset of being able to create interesting dishes, a lot of raw dishes, but make them real gourmet. And I've decided this time around my cookbooks are going to be pure gourmet, meaning every dish will be plated to look like something out of a gourmet magazine. And so they're all done. Now I've turned them over to my daughter Shelley to try them to make sure that there's nothing that needs to be fixed or tweeted, and to upgrade them if I've added any ingredients that are too much or too little. But we have so many, we have 250, that if people in the audience would like to come and make a dish, you can make anywhere from 1 to 3 dishes, and you get to take those dishes home with you as my gift. It's not a cooking class. Shelley did those last year that hundreds of people came to, and it was free, and it was just as a public service. This is for people who like to cook. And she'll be there helping but everything from casseroles to hot fudge sundaes that have less than 80 calories, figured out how to do that, to quiches with no eggs. These are all vegan and all gluten-free and without sugar. So you can call if you want to join her. This is being done every afternoon from 3 until about 7 o'clock. From 4 until 7 or 8. Call 646-926-5422 if you want to come. And we'll slate you in for one of the evenings to be in the kitchen and cooking. And then about 6 months from now, everyone will have a chance to get one of these as one of the premiums on this station. 646-926-5422 if you want to come and speed the process up so we can get them all tested. From our environmental segment today, glyphosate, disrupting root systems and destroying soil nutrients and eliminating earthworms, from Julie Wilson from Natural News. Quote, more than 100 million pounds of the weed killer glyphosate is applied annually to crops in the United States, contributing to cancers such as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and liver, pancreas, and thyroid cancer, among other health complications. One of the main ingredients of Monsanto's Roundup herbicide, glyphosate, not only is a threat to human health, but is aggressively altering our environment in ways that could have long-term consequences. One of the most recent concerns regarding the widespread application of glyphosate is the impact that it's having on soil nutrients. Some experts allege the USDA scientists are purposely covering up critical information regarding potentially irreversible soil damage caused by glyphosate. When the herbicide is sprayed on what is called traited or GMO crops, it eventually moves into the soil from the plant's root system, a complex environment relying upon certain bacteria, fungi, and minerals in the soil to function. When the root system is balanced, crops are more capable of fighting off disease and photosynthesis is improved. However, scientists are beginning to understand that the application of pesticides can disrupt this essential system, resulting in the plant's death, according to a report by the New York Times. Quote, because glyphosate moves into the soil from the plant, it seems to affect the rhizosphere, the ecology around the root zone, which in turn can affect plant health. And that's according to the latest report. So, one more reason why we shouldn't be using these pesticides. Now, here's something for our talkback segment. It's a very brief article in Psychology Today by Dr. Mac Hicks. It's entitled, All Kids Should Go to College, A Great America Myth. The Case Against College. Let's look at the case against college. The insistence that every child can and should attend college has created a bottleneck that hurts those who are qualified for college and an even greater barrier for those who are not qualified for abstract academics, kids who should be turning their many talents in other directions. So why this love affair with college? Many Americans think college equals success, and they naturally want the very best for their children. Similar to infatuation, this love affair may not last long. Most children should not go to college. Substantial numbers don't complete college in 4 years and are not successful financially. This misperception may go back to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant WASP elite that ran our country in the 1800s. They have supposedly been replaced by a meritocracy system, which is based on talent, but many still strive, consciously or subconsciously, for the Yale, the Harvard, the Princeton community, and the contacts that maintain the old establishment. Bruce McCall, a successful writer who was a high school dropout, commented on his doubts about succeeding in New York City. Quote, everybody knew that everybody connected with the smart magazines came from old money, went to Harvard or at least Yale, summered at the Cape, married a debutante, recited horse while playing squash, and mixed with literary royalty at chick dinner parties in Manhattan penthouses. From graduation day onward, this superior breed trod an endless red carpet to various forms of glory. Social snobbery. The cultural critic Camille Paglia was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying that what's driving the push towards universal college graduation is social snobbery on the part of a lot of upper-middle-class families who want the sticker in their car window. According to Joseph Epstein, the merit in our meritocracy may not be genuine. Quote, the only thing that normal undergraduate schooling prepares a person for is more schooling. Having been a good student, in other words, means nothing more than that. One was good at school. One had the discipline to do what one was told, learned the skill of quick response to oral and written questions, figured out what professors wanted, and gave it to them. This perception of college as the preferred goal of all students is the most difficult single problem that must be overcome if we are to allow individuals to flow naturally towards their own inclinations and abilities. Most parents, especially middle-class parents, have one question when visiting friends that they haven't seen for a while. How's Janie? Where is she going to college? Of course, it is assumed that she is going to college. If she isn't, the friends might see Janie's parents as failures, and the parents themselves would feel embarrassed. Some high schools have debate teams that debate other schools, and sometimes these competitions advertise themselves not as a debate between high schools, but as college bowls. Other high schools in wealthy areas are given names such as University High School. If we accept the college for everyone concept, these reactions would be understandable. But there are two underlying assumptions to this position that are not valid. The first assumption is that student failure has to do with parents not pushing their kids hard enough, rather than students' ability level or motivation. The second assumption is that with concerted effort, all students can be helped. Helped to do what? It's always a nice idea to give students extra help to do anything, but fattening them up to satisfy the voracious appetite of state achievement tests? Maybe not. And maybe the failing students are trying to tell us something. The only way to counteract this misperception is success in the real world, success of advanced career studies. This will take time because of built-in stereotypes and prejudice against these students. After all, left-brain academicians make up a large share of our country's cultural critics and writers. These folks believe they are the best and brightest, and even the happiest. This carries over to newspapers and television programming as well. But psychological research has consistently shown that after people acquire a solid but modest income, additional monies do not create sustained happiness. In some ways, the university would be a world is a non-real world. It's a think tank, a finishing school, a self-congratulatory system that feeds the ego. But it is also an incubator of professional classes such as professors, physicians, lawyers, accountants, engineers, and scientists. For this system, our country expects leadership and the discovery of things that presently don't exist. These innovations will come only to the top 1 to 10% of our academic strivers. End quote, and that was from this week's Psychology Today by that doctor. My quick thoughts on this. I believe that at this moment in time, due to several interacting issues, such as student debt, the ability of lobbyists within the banking community and corporate community to make it impossible to release your debt through bankruptcy. The fact that we now have 27 states that have reintroduced debtors' prisons. Therefore, you can be arrested by a private firm. You can be put into private jails, charged for everything and every day, including a private probation officer, and for not being able to pay any debt, including student debts. We also now have the largest number of senior citizens in retirement with the largest amount of debt of student debt in our history, $12 billion. That's because our grandparents or parents co-signed on those loans and are now legally obligated. Is it right that we should burden people going into their final years of life with debt peonage when things are already at one of the most stress levels financially within income inequality in our history. What does this mean for their quality of life when they cannot afford the basics? Now, I just put this in a film when I found that there were over 10 million senior citizens living in dire poverty. No one's advocating for them. They're invisible. But let me tell you, they exist. Also, 55% of all college graduates have no jobs whatsoever. An additional 30% have jobs, but not in their designated field or in their designated field, but where there is so much competition that their wages are way below what historically they should have been entering and therefore not able to have any quality of life. For those people working, most are working in service industries like bartenders, waiters, and shops selling merchandise, etc. I think we should reapply our interest in what vocational schools could do to help people develop certain vocations in alignment with their interest, and also in the supporting system of the community college. I believe that the community college is undervalued and has always now been looked at as just a stepping stone from the community college into a traditional college. At this moment, unless you are going into a field that is known to have a surplus of jobs, like in medicine or in nursing or in engineering, that and some others, that you would be better spending your time and energies and your limited resources developing other skills, other talents that do not require the traditional academic background. And because I believe we're going to see massive social changes in the next 2 years. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours in our talkback segment. If time permits, we'll have it at the end of the show at 888-874-4888. But now we're going over to my guest because I see he is on board. We want to get right to the issue. Dr. Harold Koenig, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, as well as associate professor of medicine at Duke University's Medical School. He is also the founder and director of Duke's Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health, which is a multidisciplinary research and training program that explores the biological mechanisms by which religion and spirituality affect physical and mental outcomes. Earlier, Dr. Koenig specialized in geriatric and family medicine. He holds degrees from Stanford University and medical degree from the University of California at San Francisco. And he's written over 450 peer-reviewed papers, and he's regarded as one of the world's top experts on the interface between religion and health. His newest publication is Spirituality in Patient Care, and the Handbook on Religion and Health also. And his website is spiritualityandhealth.duke.edu. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Much of the research being conducted at your Center for Spirituality and Theology and Health at Duke focuses upon the role of belief in health. Now, this is rather difficult when you look at this as the average person or even the average clinician to get your mind wrapped around this. There are centers at Wisconsin with Richard Davidson and Andrew Newberg's program at the University of Pennsylvania and others at the University of Montreal, which otherwise tend to focus on various spiritual practices such as meditation techniques and prayer. And a scientific explanation for belief seems rather elusive. In psychological and religious inquiry, we don't consider very often what might distinguish genuine belief in a spiritual principle or higher religious values from what we might consider as wishful thinking or simply hoping for something to be true. So I raise this issue because people might feel that simply because there may be good scientific evidence showing a relationship between having a spiritual belief and having improved physical and mental health, that this means we can simply force ourselves into believing something and reap its benefits. However, I don't personally believe that that belief works that way. And one could say that belief is an embodied experience, and it is much more than reasoning the mind to believe something that to be true or not. So first, I would like you to share with us some of your experience about the scientific evidence showing that holding religious or spiritual beliefs contributes to better physical and mental health, and then please address more of the differences between what defines authentic belief and faith in higher spiritual principles and values versus a rationalized type of belief that may simply be a mental exercise or wishful thinking. The form is yours.
Well, Gary, those are some some great questions, and let me take actually the second one first, and then I'll talk about the research findings. The second question had to do, you know, with what are we talking about here? What belief are we really referring to when I talk about relationships between, well, religious belief and health? My focus and the focus of our center has really been on studying people's religious beliefs. So these are religious beliefs from a wide variety of traditions. There is not a focus on Christianity or necessarily Islam or Buddhism. It's pretty much across the board. So we're interested in studying devout religious belief and practice and how it affects people's health. Now, trying to sort out whether that's, you know, all of belief is kind of personal, and, you know, for some people it's superstitious, and for others it's wishful thinking, and, you know, it is hard to really know what exactly it is, but we're talking here about religious belief, belief in God, belief in the transcendent, and activities such as praying to God, going to religious services, reading religious scriptures, listening to religious music, volunteering for religious reasons. The focus for the work we're doing is primarily looking at religion. So, what has the research shown? The research indicates that people who are more religious, people who are more involved in religious practices, those who have stronger, more committed religious beliefs, they do better. They do better physically. They do better emotionally. They have more. They have better social connections. It's just pretty much across the board that they're healthier. They live longer. They have greater well-being, and these kinds of findings. So that's kind of a summary of it. And maybe if you've got some specific questions, I can answer them.
Sure. Thank you for the overview. That gives us a better understanding. Now, we're expecting millions of people to start to enter retirement. At the same time, we find medical conditions associated with rapid aging increasing, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, memory loss, and also those affecting our immune system. What does the science show now regarding the role of spiritual beliefs in anti-aging or from the lessening of medical problems associated with aging?
Well, that's a topic that I'm very interested in because I actually started in with my training in geriatric medicine, and then, you know, later developed got training in geriatric psychiatry. But I've really been in geriatrics, or the care of older people, really throughout most of my career. And in fact, our center is part of the Center for the Study of Aging in Human Development here at Duke University. So, you know, there's lots of connections here. As people grow older, it appears that they become more religious. Now, this doesn't happen with everybody, and people tend to, you know, if someone is a devout atheist, they're probably going to be a devout atheist when they die. But generally, if you're looking at changes over time, people tend to become more religious as they age. And consequently, if you study the religious beliefs and practices of older adults, they're considerably higher than among younger adults. Now, part of that is what's called a period effect, which means that these older adults grew up during a time when religion was more important in society than it is now. But there's also some indication that people actually, as they deal with these problems that you've mentioned, with disability, with chronic illness, with cognitive impairment, and with loss of loved ones, that they often turn to religion, maybe for the first time in their life, to make sense of these losses and these negative life experiences. and to help them to cope with them. So we see a lot of that happening. Now, as far as some of the diseases themselves, actually, some of the age-related, the disability does tend to be lower among those who are more religious, as well as a cognitive functioning appears to be the natural decline in memory and cognitive functioning appears to be less among those who are more religiously involved. So this has even been shown in studies looking at people with Alzheimer's disease, that those who are more engaged in religious activities, their progression or their, you know, the worsening of the Alzheimer's disease is actually slower than among those who are not engaged in these activities. So there's lots of connections here that we're just now starting to learn about, and we're trying to understand them.
I had a Dr. Mario Martinez on this program, a clinical psychologist from Uruguay who specializes in what you call psychoneuroimmunology and its relationship to anti-aging. And one of the areas he had focused upon is the mind-body role of the society and culture of a person and a person, let's say, how they're impacted based upon their cultural beliefs and values and their health. And we can look around today and see the adverse effects on physical and mental health among those who solely exist in a secular media and entertainment society and who simply buy into what popular culture feeds them. And social health is another area of your research. I'd like for you to speak more about that because there seems to be a good amount of evidence to support the fact that having a nurturing community around yourself contributes to having a healthier, longer life. And religious and spiritual communities can provide that support system for quite a lot of people who are struggling in the secular society and who only associate with diverse friends or coworkers. What is particularly unique about religious or spiritual communities that you find contributes to medical issues such as more rapid recovery from an illness or more mental depression from depression and other psychological disorders?
Well, Gary, you couldn't be more on target in saying that, you know, the society and particularly the media often can be toxic to our health. And, you know, we're just blasted by it everywhere on the internet and you know, over the television, and I watch a lot of it. You know, it can be very discouraging. You know, having a faith community really does make a difference for people, and one of the reasons is because part of the belief system has to do with loving your neighbor. You know, there's a real focus on forgiveness and on altruism. And as people do engage in those kinds of activities, they just do better. As you said, you know, the psychoneuroimmunology kind of kicks in, and their bodies just physiologically start working better. They heal quicker. They're less vulnerable to disease. So there's just no question that having that support, being part of a faith community, and not only getting the support from others, but giving it to others, really seems to make a difference. And actually, being involved in religious communities of this kind are actually more positive for your health, both mental and physical, than secular groups are. So there is something about being part of a community that has a similar belief system, that worships together, that prays together, that sings together, that meets regularly, that goes out to dinner or lunch after a religious services regularly. That really does seem to make a difference.
I appreciate the good work you've done and the fact that you have been able to show a junction between good science, healthcare, medicine, and a person's beliefs and the importance of a healthy, positive mindset community to give them that relationship. Thank you very much, Harold Koenig, for all your good work.
Thank you, Gary. Appreciate being on the show.
And his book is Spirituality and Patient Care, as well as Health and Wellness. His website is spiritualityandhealth.duke.edu. Now, to finish up the program, let's go over and see what you have to say about your thoughts on should everyone go to college today. Ed from Huntington, Long Island, your turn.
Yes, I'm very happy to be able to talk to you about it. When I was 16 years old, I joined the Navy, and I hadn't even completed my junior year. And now I'm talking about affirmative action here. I went to night school, got a Regis diploma, which had a lot of help from a lot of teachers and whatnot to pass it. So now I enrolled in college because I didn't have to take an entrance exam to do that. My first year in college was a total disaster. I mean, I was totally ill-prepared for an academic education because my prior education just didn't set me up for it. The Navy gave me a lot of skills and whatnot, and I took a test and I found out that I was smarter than most second-year engineering students about a lot of things, but I lacked in a lot of skills. My advisor told me at the end of the year, he said, you're just not going to make it. You better go to a trade school and learn how to do something, which I wasn't very happy about, but I figured I had to do something. Well, it worked out very well for me, you know, because I was very discouraged with going to college because I wasn't equipped to deal with it on a level.
Okay, Ed, you've made a very important point.
Affirmative action is not the best thing in the world.
Well, that's we can debate that. My emphasis here is you've made an important statement when you said that you learned a trade in a trade school. I believe that the trade schools have been denigrated. I believe that we have had bias against people who go to a trade school, making them feel as if they're less of a human being and less of a contributor to society. And I'd like to take a look at this society. If we eliminated all of our tradespersons from it, what we would have would be barren lots. We would just be all living in the woods. Let us not denigrate those who built our country, continue to maintain it, and its infrastructures and are an essential part of it. I believe that there is an elitism, and that is palpable. So for those who could benefit from college, good, then go to college. But for those who it would just indebt them or their families, think well before you do that, and think about other courses for your life. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from one of your listeners in France, and she says that my question is this, whether or not to vaccinate my dogs. They're puppies. They're 3 months old. She says, I live in France where it's the law to vaccinate them since they are a pit bull breed. And she says, I'm stuck with the 5 healthy puppies, and I don't know what to do. I know that I don't want them to get any diseases, but like many of your listeners, I'm against vaccinating, so I don't know what to do. So what is your opinion on that?
All right. I believe that more dogs and cats are killed because of vaccinations than people. And the science in vaccinating a dog is simply non-existent. I've looked at it. I wrote a book on it, Natural Pet Care. I wrote articles on it. I work with vets who also agree. And that's why they became holistic vets. But what I would do, and they use, and it's accepted and respected, homeopathy. Let them get a homeopathic vaccine for their pets, for the dogs in this case.
Well, that's excellent.
All right. This way it doesn't hurt the dog or cat. But in the United States, we could probably cut the lifespan of an animal by half because of our vaccinating schedule, especially when it comes to rabies vaccines, how often you have to give them, even though your pet may have no exposure whatsoever to a rabid animal. And I've written about it. I'm against it. They have to show me first the science that it will not injure the animal's lifespan. They've never done those long-term studies, ever, not one. So once again, it's pharmaceutical industry and the lesser minds in the animal veterinary field working together. The more expanded minds, the curious minds, they find the truth and it changes them. All right, anything else?
Okay. Yeah, well, there's been a lot of emails coming in about the protests in Hong Kong and China. And people are saying that, again, this is something that you've been talking about for years. You said it was going to happen in Greece. You said it was going to happen in Spain. You said it was going to happen all over. And people are very impressed with the amount of people that were protesting in Hong Kong, and now it seems like they've kind of wrapped it up. They're trying to arrest people and things like that, and people are starting to disperse. And again, you know, again, you called this, you talked about this, and we don't hear about it in any of the media, especially the mainstream media.
You hear very little. You have to, if you want good media, not perfect, they have their limitations also and biases, but Al Jazeera dwarfs anything else. The BBC is also highly politicized, but when it does good independent journalism, which it does, then it would be second. So Al Jazeera first, BBC second. Those would be your two best sources of information in the United States and around the world. And you're going to see more protests. They're not going to stop. They'll clean up this group and therefore will feel good about the upcoming next elections where the Chinese government will select all the candidates. And that's what the protesters were against. They wanted people who were not affiliated with the Chinese doctrine and party principles to be able to run for Hong Kong elections. They won because they got the attention of the world on their side. They have regrouped. Remember, the biggest thing that all protesters in the world have is anonymous. The single most important ally is anonymous. Anonymous will determine what happens in the future in exposing corruption in all administrations, in all governments, in all corporations. And those people are really connected with all of those movements, including Hong Kong. All you've seen is one battle. There's going to be 1,000 more behind it. Thanks for the call. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today, it's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and the star of the show are the opinions of the listeners.
Great. Utrice Lead right now.